Hey, it's Liz Kelly, and welcome to the Ringer Podcast Network. We're excited to announce our latest podcast launching this week called Behind the Billions. Coming from the two co-creators of Billions, Brian Koppelman and David Levine give a behind-the-scenes look into Billions Season 5. Following each episode's airing on Showtime, the podcast will unpack the writing of the script, exclusive stories from production, interviews with cast and crew, and much more. The first episode is out now, so make sure to subscribe to Behind the Billions on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Sean Fennessy.
I'm Amanda Dobbins.
And this is The Big Picture, a conversation show about just how dope the sea really is. After polling the fine listeners of this show, you chose not to celebrate James L. Brooks on his 80th birthday and not to dig into the great works of 1970s science fiction cinema. No, you asked us to focus on the great unknowable blue, the briny depths of water that cover the vast majority of this planet. You wanted us to talk about movies set at sea, and so we must welcome back the Ahab of The Big Picture, ever on the hunt for the frog sheriff of his mind. It's Captain Chris Ryan. Hey, Chris.
Arr!
So this week, Chris and I appeared on an episode of The Rewatchables dedicated to the great Crimson Tide. So we're making this a little bit of a theme week here. Crimson Tide is a submarine movie which qualifies for this episode. There are some movies that don't qualify for this episode. Amanda, I was hoping you could help us understand some of the ground rules we set when exploring movies set at sea.
Yes, we had a very informed conversation about types of bodies of water and the classification of the oceans and its various runoffs and what would qualify and what would not. And let me just say, again, no one here is a lawyer. No one here is a marine biologist. No one here is a geologist. No one is any like accomplished, educated career.
Not a single accredited seaman among us.
So we're going to get this really wrong, but here's what we decided. So obviously this is a movie about the sea. My understanding is that a sea is not an ocean, but the ocean does qualify. However, rivers do not qualify. Streams do not qualify, apparently, according to this document that Sean wrote in the middle of the night that I'm reading. No estuaries is also on here, which I think is controversial because I do think estuaries have a connection to the sea, Sean.
Well, they're essentially mouth formations coming out of a river. So I think given the river quality of an estuary, we're canceling estuaries here. Chris, how do you feel about these rulings?
Well, I think it's good. I mean, what is an estuary?
It's the tidal mouth of a large river where the tide meets the stream.
So that means Prince of Tides out.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Sorry, Babs.
Yeah, I think it's important to just say, like, for me personally, I think if you can see the other side, it's not the sea.
So I think it's a strong ground rule.
And that eliminates river runs through it. That eliminates River Wild. Primarily, it eliminates any canoe-based movie, you know? So I think that those ground rules are really important.
Chris, many years ago, you wrote a blog post that has miraculously survived through the wreckage of internet nonsense. That blog post is called "The Sea Is Dope." I knew the moment it was published that it would be a significant document 10 years later. Why is the sea so dope? What inspired you to write that piece? Why are movies set at sea so cool?
Like a lot of my great work, Sean, I did it 11 feet from you, and I think I did it in half an hour. And I did it because we needed a blog post that day and a movie trailer had come out. No, you know, I think for me, I love space movies and I love movies on the sea, but the sea is knowable and it's also unknowable. So anybody who's ever had that feeling, Amanda, you can help me as an avid swimmer. Like what is it when you step off the shelf of the first few feet off the shore? Is there like is that called something?
You mean when you like get into the ocean?
Yeah, but then when you walk, you're walking and then the floor drops off.
Right. I guess when you like break, you go under the waves and yeah, you kind of get past the break, I guess.
Yes, past the break. When you get past the break, you kind of just really do get in touch with the infinite for a second there. Because you're just like, I am just this speck in this massive body of water and it doesn't care anything about my individuality or my hopes and dreams and likes and retweets. And I could disappear. And that is, terrifying and invigorating at the same time. Like, I'm never going to get to go to space, I think we could safely assume, you know, especially...
Don't sell yourself short, Chris.
Yeah. No, never say never, Chris.
My carpal tunnel, they're never going to let me on, you know? But I could go to sea, theoretically, tomorrow. I could get a schooner, you know, I could get a wind jammer, and I could just take to the waves. And that's the thing, is it's always been... the everyday man, the everyday woman's escape. It's their opportunity for adventure and self-discovery.
Amanda,
naval combat as well.
That's a good point. All different kinds of films can happen at sea. I didn't vet this idea with you beforehand, Amanda, but I had a feeling like you would be on board with it. Now that we are actually live and recording the show, are you on board with this idea?
Yes, of course. Both because I too, like Chris, love the ocean. I'm a huge fan of going to the beach and actually being in the water, unlike certain other people on this podcast who will remain nameless. Do you want to talk about your relationship to the ocean now? Should we just get it out of the way?
I love the ocean. It's the beach I hate. It's the sand. And also, given that I have the complexion of Casper the Ghost, I ought not be in the sun. But the actual ocean itself, I think I'm with both of you guys. I love to take a dip.
Okay, good. That's good, because it was going to get ugly otherwise. No, I think Chris put it really well in terms of the appeal of the actual ocean, which is a place that is both accessible and also completely unknown. And you have to respect the power of the ocean. But in terms of a movie, I just really like it for formal reasons. It's constraints. You know, there are only so many ways for you to be on the ocean. You're on a vessel. There are only so many people, and then only so many things can happen. So I do like the formality, quite literally, of it. And it produces interesting, it gives boundaries while also allowing for a lot of different things to happen, because you can have an action adventure. You also can have a romance. You can have a comedy. You definitely can have an existential breakdown, which we'll talk about. And also it's beautiful. With the exception of the submarine films, it's also often filmed outside, which, as we know, I personally like. But yeah, I mean, I love a sea vista, you know?
The cool thing about sea movies is that, you know, we've done these top fives for so many different things, and often we'll get feedback that's just like, oh, how could you leave this out? How could you not have this ranked number one? I think that you could pull 100 different people and get 100 different top fives, because the sea means different things to different people. Some people look at it and they want terror. Some people look at it and they want delight and wonder. Some people look at it and they want, tests of metal, you know? So it depends on what you're looking for, but you can get almost anything out of movies made around the sea.
I think there's something a little bit aspirational about this particular topic right now, because so few people are able to go to the sea during quarantine. But I was thinking, unlike courtroom thrillers or erotic thrillers, movies we've focused on during this period while we're trying to conjure content, there are still sea movies coming out. I watched a movie called Sea Fever on VOD last week that was okay. And then earlier this year, we had Underwater with Kristen Stewart. Last year, we had Crawl, the alligator horror movie. They're still making movies that are in this vein, unlike so many of the other movies that I feel like we grew up with. And that's kind of surprising, because it's really difficult and expensive to make movies at sea. You know, usually those kinds of films have gone by the wayside in the last 10, 20
literally
years.
Sink directors, yeah.
Yeah, and that it's one of those sort of caution, you hear cautionary tales all the time about a director getting in a giant pool that's been built by the studio, and then, you know, either you're James Cameron or you sink. I don't actually know what accounts for that. I don't know why we keep getting to see these movies, you know, 25 years after Waterworld. What do you think that's about, Amanda?
Well, as Chris said, it's kind of one of the two great unknowns. You can do a space movie or you can do a sea movie. And I think they both have their logistical difficulties. But I do like not the familiarity of the sea, because listen, when I'm going into the sea, it's got to be a very, very calm wave situation. I'm monitoring the surf report, but if it's a bad day for surfers, it's a good day for me. And I'm not trying to go out to the great depths. I don't really want to be in a submarine, though I did a lot of reading about the history of submarines last night, and I'd love to talk to you guys about it. I'm fascinated by them. But there is, you don't have to make up like a different type of person. You don't have to imagine like extraterrestrial life. You're using vessels and people and things that are typically like from this world, which, you know, I still respond to that more than I respond to like really, really, really deep science fiction. It's easier for me to access the humanity or the relatability of things I kind of recognize. I guess I'm a simple person. So, and I'm not the only person that feels that way. As Chris latched on to something, the sea is dope. A lot of people just really want to, it's right there and you can see it, but you can't always access it. And that is just like extremely like fertile ground for movies and for literature and for life.
Guys, when Quar ends, we got to pitch an erotic courtroom thriller set on a boat. What are we doing? Lawyers that fuck on deck. Come on.
I think you have our title. That's pretty good. You might be able to find that movie on Pornhub right now, I think, Chris. Okay. Should we go to our top fives? Chris, anything else you need to say about these films?
No, I think it'll come out through this. I think these are also going to be a really cool personality test. Because I, you know, every one of mine are just like the terror that you find within and also around you. And Amanda's is going to be like, God, I love Aquatic Blue. You know, like.
Yeah. Okay, Chris, why don't you start us off then? What's your number five?
My number five is one of my favorite non-Jaws shark movies. Now I will just say that, you know, I'm sure Jaws will come up, but I almost put Jaws in like a Citizen Kane realm of is Citizen Kane a newspaper movie? Sure, but you know, it's also so much more. But high up there on my shark attack list is Open Water, which is a film that came out, I believe, in 2013, if I remember correctly. And it was based on a true story and is literally a transcription of my nightmares. It's about a couple who go scuba diving. And the boat accidentally leaves them behind and they are stuck in the middle of the ocean. And you can imagine what happens.
Daniel, is that a shark?
Maybe. Or a dolphin.
If it was a dolphin, you'd be on your way over there to play with it. You obviously think it was a shark.
It is kind of a faux found footage movie. It is essentially a found footage horror film, and it painstakingly depicts what would actually happen, you know, if you were stranded out in the middle of the ocean with your scuba gear and your significant other and spent the first 30 minutes blaming one another for who could have, you know, because it was your fault because we decided to go on this thing. And then it was your fault because you went away from the group. And then shit really goes wrong. And it's a really tense movie, but it's just a two-hander and you wind up really, 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 having a lot of empathy for these people as you would, because it's a terrible story, but it's really like a complete white knuckle ride.
In looking back on it, I had forgotten that this movie only cost $120,000 to make.
And made like $55 million, right?
Yeah, that is absolutely incredible because it is terrifying and it does not seem to be working with tons of visual effects, you know, added in post. You know, this is a very stripped down kind of a movie, but it is absolutely horrifying.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of it, and the movie was made by people who are also divers, and it kind of reminded me a little bit of Free Solo, where it's like you can't make that movie unless you can climb. You know, I don't think they could have made Open Water without filmmakers who are proficient at diving.
That's a good one. Amanda, I presume that you have not experienced open water since it's actually literally your nightmare.
It actually literally is, and I'm so stressed out right now just hearing about it. I think I both love the ocean and I'm like really afraid of the ocean. I'm like, the ocean will fuck you up. It is really a thing to be taken seriously. And for some reason, I don't really like watching horror like slasher movies where there's like a person coming to kill you or whatever. But that doesn't like really scare me the way the prospect of just like being swept away by the ocean. It's actually a great fear of mine.
Yeah.
So I won't be seeing that.
It's like Amanda loves the beach. And Amanda likes boats that are stable and sound crafts. She, like, you do not like the ocean.
I respect the ocean. Yeah. I don't know that I need to live on it. Yeah. No, my response is not like what I need to do is just be alone on my boat. I thought it was interesting, and maybe I'm wrong. We don't have a lot of the people, the one person just like stuck on a raft in the middle of the ocean movies on this list, which is my definite absolute nightmare. That I think I would actually be glad to have my partner in this situation just because I would panic and I need someone else to just be like, okay, what you have to do is like tread water. But no, it's too scary for me. It's not how I'm trying to enjoy, you know, the majesty of nature.
I toyed with putting All Is Lost on my list, the J.C. Shandor, Robert Redford movie from, I think, 2013. And the truth is that it's kind of a tough hang. It's a difficult movie to return to. It's not very rewatchable, even though it's extraordinarily well made and interesting and tells this story of existential dread. I have a similar relationship to it that I do to Castaway. Castaway has just never really been one of my movies because it makes me think of an experience that I would hate. And not a lot of my movies represent that necessarily. Amanda, why don't you give us your number five, which I think will be slightly more optimistic.
Sort of. My number five is The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, which is the 2004 Wes Anderson movie starring Bill Murray and, you know, Wes Anderson's cast of movie stars and friends. And I chose this movie for a lot of reasons. I have a great affection for it. And also, I think that affection has grown as I've gotten older. I remember seeing it at the time and being like, huh, this is a little loose. This is a little all over the place. But there is something that I really enjoy about it now and also possibly speaks to the possibilities of the ocean. I did also think, as a person who does respect the ocean and also who respects reading, that I needed to have one choice that at least like acknowledges the existence of Moby Dick and in many ways is like not quite parodying it, but is like sending it up. But at least the plot structure is somewhat there. So we can all acknowledge that Moby Dick definitely, you know, taught a lot of us to think about the ocean in a certain way. But I prefer like red hipster hats to the pointy hats that people wear on the in the old timey Moby Dicks. So I'm going with Life Aquatic. I do have to say, in terms of art direction, in terms of, you know, what the sea looks like in Amanda's mind when I'm like, I'm sitting here in quarantine and I'm like, I want to go to the ocean. Maybe I even want to set sail on a boat, you know? Maybe I have that longing. The boat looks like this in my head, and the sea is the blue that Chris mentioned earlier. And there is everyone has like just perfect uniforms, and there is a guy singing, doing David Bowie covers in Portuguese. And it's whimsical is the word that's always used with Wes Anderson, but I find it to be both sincere and able to deal with its own sincerity. View of the sea, which is a great summary of me, pretty
that's
much.
It's a ridiculous movie that's quite touching. I love Life Aquatic.
I do too. It reminds me that I didn't consider any of the Jacques Cousteau movies when I was doing my list, because obviously the Life Aquatic heavily inspired by the life of Jacques Cousteau, the legendary sea explorer and documentarian. Jacques Cousteau won 3 Oscars, The Silent World, one of the best documentaries ever made. And I don't know, that would have been fun to revisit, but I didn't do that like a fool. My number five is The Poseidon Adventure.
You want another life? Then take me!
Returned to The Poseidon Adventure for the first time in about 25 years last night.
You're talking about the original, not the remake.
Not the remake, certainly not the sequel Beyond the Poseidon Adventure, which is a movie I've decided I have to watch immediately after watching the trailer last night. But the original Poseidon Adventure, which is really the template setting action extravaganza, star-studded, Irwin Allen, mega explosive, big tent movie that we saw. You know, if you like Independence Day, for example, or you like Michael Bay movies, The Poseidon Adventure is the blueprint. This is where one of the very first movies that isn't Around the World in 80 Days or It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, the first like action movie that has way too many famous people in it. It's about obviously a massive cruise liner that capsizes in the Pacific after a 90-foot tidal wave crashes into it, and it's like a fascinating document. It's simultaneously like a very stupid movie. When you're watching the movie, you're gonna be like, "This is badly acted. The plot is ridiculous. Every performance is off key." And it's also, on the other hand, for a movie that was made 50 years ago, like an incredible accomplishment. It won an Academy Award for its special effects design. Shelley Winters was nominated for an Academy Award for her performance in the movie. Chris, I mentioned our Crimson Tide rewatchables. This is one of the all-time Gene Hackman yelling at people movies.
Yeah, he plays like a pastor, right?
Yes, he plays a reverend who is struggling with his faith and attempting to guide the handful of survivors out through the up and out through the hull of the ship. And man, he's just super mad at everybody. He's just screaming at Ernest Borgnine and Stella Stevens and all these children that are following him. It's a ridiculous movie, but it's also the actual crash, the actual capsizing of the cruise liner is just an amazing action sequence. If you like movies of this kind. And I think one of the reasons to recommend it is if you watch it on iTunes, as I did, you will go down the rabbit hole of all the movies that followed this movie. And the one that I discovered that I'm super excited to find a reason to talk about at some point is called The Swarm. Are you guys familiar with The Swarm?
I'm not.
It's a 1978 disaster horror movie about a killer bee invasion in Texas that just so happens to star Michael Caine, Catherine Ross, Richard Widmark, Richard Chamberlain, Olivia de Havilland, Ben Johnson, Lee Grant, Henry Fonda. This is one of the greatest casts ever assembled in the history of movies, written and directed by Irwin Allen, who produced The Poseidon Adventure.
Michael Caine in Texas?
Yep. A native Texan. The Poseidon Adventure is just one of those movies that it kind of set the stage for Endgame. It set the stage for The Rock. It set the stage for a lot of certain kinds of movies. And it's the kind of movie that can only take place on the ocean. That's number five. Chris, what's number four?
Number four for me is White Squall. So this is a 1996 movie from Ridley Scott in his more of a gun for hire era when he was doing like Thelma and Louise, which is obviously great. And then he also does 1492, which is not as good. And G.I. Jane is in there. This is right before he goes returns to form with Gladiator. But White Squall is essentially his attempt at making a Steven Spielberg movie. It's about a boys academy on a windjammer boat in the Caribbean that's going to go on for an entire semester. It's going to go on a semester long cruise, and the kids have to like work on the boat and sail the boat. And there's only a couple of adults. It's Jeff Bridges in one of my favorite Jeff Bridges performances. And John Savage plays their English teacher. And there's a couple of other, Jeff Bridges' wife, Caroline Goodall, is on there. And it gets at the Lord Jim kind of Joseph Conrad young man at sea thing. And I think some of these movies are probably, you know, place where they place because of like when we saw them. And I saw this right as I was getting out of high school and starting to read a little bit more seriously. So like the idea of going out and having an adventure and finding your place in the world is very explicitly the theme of this movie, as is. You're just never going to really want to be in a white squall, guys. Let me tell you that. it's not like a Cinderella thing where you might get out. It's pretty much that's a wrap for you. And there's essentially Ridley Scott has about like 10 or 11 shots in here, which are like, is that a painting? Because Ridley Scott just has that eye. And then the execution of the storm on this boat is, you will feel like sea spray hitting you when you're watching this scene. Even now in 96, they shot it on something called a no horizon tank in Malta, where they did all the boat stuff in a tank, but you couldn't, like, it's a special kind of tank where you can't see like the end of it essentially. So I thought that little production note was cool, but it's corny in places. Scott Wolf is just like going for it for Tom Cruise, but it is kind of like a throwback to a type of movie that nobody bothers to make anymore because it's not anything more than what it is, which is like, what if a bunch of kids, boys became men on the sea? It's like, you wouldn't be able to get that made. They'd all have to also get superhero powers. But yeah, it's incredible. And it has a special place in my heart because of when I saw it.
Chris, should we remake White Squall in the DC universe?
Yeah. Suicide Squad. Suicide Squad 3 White Squall. Let's go.
Honestly, a superhero movie could stand to happen on the ocean aside from Aquaman. Aquaman's not making our list here today. Actually, Amanda, is Aquaman your number one?
No, believe it or not.
Okay. What's your number
four? Just missed it. My number four, speaking of movies that we saw at a certain point in our lives made a big impression on us. My number four is The Little Mermaid.
Look at this stuff. Isn't it neat? Wouldn't you think my collection's complete?
Yes, that's right. I picked an animated film. This is the 1999 Disney movie. Sean is like raising his arms in celebration. So this is the movie that starts the Disney renaissance of all of the animated and the Disney princess movies that, you know, we are now just living with every day of our lives. I was 5 when it came out, and I realized when I was rewatching that I have definitely seen this more than any other of the Disney movies and know all of the words and was definitely singing some of the songs this morning and was chastised in my home because it was too early. But listen, this movie as a movie about a young woman trying to make her way in the world is a disaster. And do not do that anything that Ariel does. She is just like, I saw this guy once on a beach and now I need to be a human and I'm going to give my voice away and just like a deal with terrible terms to this total monster. And then, of course, Ursula just completely reneges on the deal. Her dad gets kidnapped. I mean, it's like Ariel is not a role model. Okay, let me just get that out there. But in terms of what it means to actually live under the sea, you know, these movies are not exploring that as fully as they could. And I'm learning a lot about mermaids. I'm learning a lot about what it means to be the crustaceans. I'm learning that they too look at the land as something that is unknown and worth exploring. You know, it goes both ways. And I just have to say, Part of Your World is really underrated as far as the Disney songs go. That stuff is important. Chris, have you ever heard Part of Your World?
No, I'm just
part
imagining
of their world, I'm sorry.
The Marriage Story meme I'm gonna make about the two about you betraying me and liking an animated movie. But you told me you didn't like drawings.
I don't really, but this is a drawing of the sea. This is one of the times where I think it's defensible to make an animated movie because you can't go film like the fish who talk in real life. So you have to draw it and then you
wait. You can't talk to fish in real life?
The fish can't talk back to you, Sean. At least not yet. We haven't gotten there. Okay. So
you haven't seen Aquaman, clearly.
That's true. I did actually. No, I have not seen Aquaman. I really enjoy this movie, even if it has some problematic elements. It, in terms of bringing the sea to life, I do think it formed my concept of what the ocean could be. I still think there's a cool crustacean band down there that I want to be a part of.
How do you feel about a double feature screening of The Little Mermaid and the FX series Mrs. America as a kind of second wave feminism portrait? Would that work well?
Yeah, it would. Again, I said, do not do anything that Ariel does, okay? Just don't.
My number 4 is a movie called Lifeboat.
Don't look now, but I think we have a skipper.
Who elected Mr. Rittenhouse?
Mr. Rittenhouse.
It was made in 1944. It's directed by the great Alfred Hitchcock. It is probably most notable for being the first of his quote-unquote limited setting movies, which is like a trick that he designed to make, I think, ultimately more interesting movies than a lot of his contemporaries by confining himself to a certain set of rules. You know, his most famous limited setting is probably Rear Window with Jimmy Stewart trapped in his apartment observing crimes. Dial M for Murder is similar in this way. Also Rope, the murder mystery that takes place all in one apartment. Lifeboat takes place entirely in a lifeboat at sea. It also happens to be a World War II movie that, you know, is, you know, about German U-boats and a collection of English sailors who were blown up by one of those U-boats. And it turns into a kind of mystery movie rather than a survival movie because a German sailor makes his way onto this lifeboat that is largely occupied by Englishmen. And that starts the hunt for whether this person is merely a sailor on the ship or the captain of the German U-boat. It reminds me a lot of And Then There Were None, the Agatha Christie story. And it's incredibly intense, awkward character story that Hitchcock isn't always necessarily great at, but he's got this incredible cast. Tallulah Bankhead, the great silent film actress, one of the stars of the movie, Hume Cronin. Many people will recognize William Bendix, Walter Slezak. And it's a funny portrait of how people respond to terrible circumstances. Tallulah Bankhead's character is completely unflappable throughout the entire movie, despite the fact that she is lost at sea on a lifeboat with 9 soldiers. And the soldiers are losing their minds and completely disintegrating in front of her. And it's just a really cleverly crafted movie that kind of operates in 3 different genres. And also kind of signals the way forward for a lot of Hitchcock's best movies. So it felt like a good opportunity to give it a shout out. Chris, what's your number 3?
My number three is Perfect Storm. So
do it. Do it. Just do it again.
You and me, Bobby. Forever. We talked about A Perfect Storm a little while ago with Mark Wahlberg, but I guess I'm on Perfect Storm Island, but that island is washed away by the giant North Atlantic swells that George Clooney drives his boat straight into in search for more lobster. I thought this movie was incredible. It's a classic Castle Rock blockbuster entertainment with a little bit of brains and like a little bit of heart. It's George Clooney, Mark Wahlberg, Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio, Diane Lane, John Hawkes, John C. Reilly. It's just a great ensemble, and it's essentially about Massachusetts Cape Cod fishermen going out for like one last big haul of the season because the like, times are tight, money's tight. And they go out and they're really driving for it. And they go out to this point that you're really not supposed to go to. But if you do go to it, the lobster is just incredible there. And they get stuck in the perfect storm. And you can imagine how that goes. You know, there's some really outrageous accent work going on in this movie. But this is Wolfgang Peterson, who did Das Boot. He really knows his way around the sea. And I think it's great. I just think that this movie is one of the great like kind of disaster movies of that era. A lot of these movies for me are around the time when I first really started falling in love with, or at least going to the movies a lot. Like I've noticed that there's a lot of like mid-90s to early 2000s for these. But I think that when you first see these movies in the theater, that's like kind of the best way to see them.
I haven't seen The Perfect Storm since it came out. I seem to remember having some trouble with the performances, even though it was like an amazing spectacle, and it like paired very similarly to something like the Poseidon Adventure. Yeah. Amanda, are you on board with this pick?
I absolutely am, and I just want to say also that if we just go a little bit further, we can get some really great lobster. Is just how I would get anyone into any type of problem ever. So I'd like to say sorry. I haven't seen it in a while either. It is one of the first things that you think of when you think of like movies set at sea, but I just knew that Chris would take care of it. And quite frankly, I can't do the voice work that Chris can, so I didn't
you
put it on
me,
my list.
You and me, Bobby. It's no great shakes.
Chris, it literally sounds like you're doing Bobby Kennedy. Amanda, what's your number three?
My number three is The Lady Eve.
He's returning to his book. He's deeply immersed in it. He sees no one except... Watch his head turn when that kid goes by.
Won't do you any good, dear. He's a bookworm, but swing him anyway.
Oh, now how about this one? How would you like that hanging on your Christmas tree?
Yes, the Preston Sturges romantic comedy from 1941. Again, this is another one when I had thought of movies set at sea. This is
a great pick.
Somehow one of the first that came to mind, even though it is. Much of it takes place on an ocean liner. And it does have, it's my kind of adventure at sea, if you will. And I want to say that I feel really dumb putting The Lady Eve at number three, because it is one of the greatest romantic comedies and quite frankly, greatest comedies or films ever made, in my opinion. I truly love this movie. Sean, I know that you love it as well. It's at number three because the ocean is just more of a setting and a mood than a character in the film. But that's okay. I do think that it fits into the idea of things can happen at sea that maybe wouldn't happen elsewhere. And it's a place where you get a little bit looser and people meet each other and people say things or do things that they might not otherwise. And also just in terms of falling in love with like a beautiful ocean vista behind you. Very formative for Amanda Dobbins.
Yeah. One of my favorite movies of all time. There's a poster of this movie in my office. I will say that I feel like the first half works a lot better than the second half. And that's where the movie largely takes place, on that ocean liner in the first half, mm-hmm. when, you know, Fonda and Stanwyck fall in love. And you're right. There is like an intoxicating experience that you can have in a setting like that, that can quickly dissipate as soon as you leave the ocean. My number three is Finding Nemo.
So what's a couple of bites like you doing out so late, eh?
Nothing. We're not doing anything. We're not even out.
Great! Then how'd you morsels like to come to a little get-together I'm having?
You mean like a party?
Another animated movie that, when I revisited it, just made me feel a lot better. Chris, I would ask you to refrain from commenting, about this beautiful film about a father in search of his lost son and what the bonds are that we create as human beings and how vast the world is and how we can lose touch with people and how we have to go and find them to reconnect.
Chris, so you've never seen The Little Mermaid and you've never seen Finding Nemo.
Is Nemo about a snail? What's it about?
No, he's a little fish. He's like a little orange
but
fish.
There's like
he's a clown fish.
Isn't there
just like,
a little,
you, Chris, he's a clown fish.
There's like a fish that looks like Greedo from Star Wars in this one, right?
What are you talking about?
Isn't there like a fish with like things coming out of its head like a blowfish or something?
Well,
in Finding Nemo?
There is a blowfish in the film, yes.
And what kind of like emotional like role does he function in this movie? Because like I know fish are really demonstrative with their feelings.
Well, he's a sidekick. He lives in a tank in an Australian dentist's office where Nemo is accidentally delivered. And Marlin, his father, played by Albert Brooks, is on a quest to find him in the ocean. Turns out he's not actually in the ocean. He's in a fish tank in a dentist's office and he has to find his way out to reconnect with his father. Incredible story.
The fish tank part is funny. The sea is more of a utopia in Finding Nemo.
Of an idea. Yeah.
Yeah. Than in Little Mermaid, which I think honestly reflects the realities of, you know, people longing.
Of ocean life. Yeah. No, for sure.
And
yeah. Yeah.
Chris, why do you hate children and childhood so much?
No, I love it. You know what I mean? It's important to give kids realistic representations of the world around them. And whenever you can have like talking fish and mermaids and stuff, it really sets them up for success in life.
Chris, if you were a father, do you think at the age of 3 or 4, you would sit your children down and just show them White Squall and tell them this is what the sea is truly like?
I'd be like, this is what you're going to be doing senior year of high school when I send you on your... You're like the albatross to go sailing around Haiti and really learn from Jeff Bridges what the world is about.
People listening to this podcast know what Finding Nemo is and how great it is, and I won't have you blaspheme it any longer. What's your number two, Chris?
My number two is Master and Commander. And it is a Peter Weir movie starring Russell Crowe. I think, you know, it's funny. We just did Gladiator Rewatchable, so we've been taught, and I've done several Russell Crowe movies as rewatchable, so I've been thinking a lot about Russell Crowe over the last like year or so. I think this is a pretty pivotal movie for him because I think that this is where he was like, when this movie didn't like pop off the way he wanted to, I think he was like, fuck it. Because they had planned on making several of these. These are based on Patrick O'Brien's series of novels about a British naval commander named Jack Aubrey. And it's Russell Crowe and Paul Bettany. Paul Bettany is essentially his sidekick, his you know, Dr. Watson or whatever. And the mystery of the movie is essentially they are sailing around in the Pacific looking for this French boat they're at war with, and its depiction of naval combat from that era and also life on a boat for military men of that era is harrowing. And it's not like unwatchable, but I will say that it has one scene which is like an all-time look away scene. Is the on-deck surgery that they perform at one point. But it is literate and funny and sweet and smart. And also, like, Peter Weir is just one of the great sort of outdoors directors that we've ever had. Like, a guy who understands how beautiful and terrifying nature can be. And the naval battles that are depicted in this movie are stunning, including the one at the very end.
Chris, let me ask you a question about this movie.
Okay.
There is a sort of Daily Caller-esque, fervid, cult-like appreciation for this movie among certain quarters. I think it's good. Uh-huh. It's certainly very well made, and Peter Weir is a great filmmaker. But Amanda, I don't know if you've had any experience with this either. I don't really get the cult of this movie.
So I think that there is a huge... If you read some of these books at a certain period of your life, you're like, that's it. That's my story. Captain Jack and these guys, and they're out on the high seas fighting for Her Majesty's Navy. And I think that that has a lot to do with it. So like, if you got into the story in that, because like there's a huge series of books that I think people have been indoctrinated to. I think the thing I like about it is how seriously it takes its subject matter. Like, it's not tongue in cheek. There's not a feeling of playing dress up. It's like everything feels very naturalistic and true to life, and the performances are really, really, really strong in this movie. But I accept the fact that it obviously never found an audience the way it was supposed to.
My theory is just that this is like Chris's costume dramas. And, you know, I can't, Chris, I can't get you to like watch Sense and Sensibility to save your life. No, I'm, you know, I, but, or, and there is a whole group of people who are not interested in, but it, that type of serious literary based, lots of, you know, corsets and stuff. And I understand that, but it's the same time period. They're also literary based. There is that seriousness and that sense of duty and honor and the way things are done, and also just like ridiculous hats, like truly, truly ridiculous hats, and like, you know, weird diseases like scurvy.
Yeah.
So I think to each his or her own costume drama is my theory on it.
I think that's a good call. The only Captain Jack I recognize is Billy Joel's Captain Jack. Amanda, what's your number two?
Well, should I do my number two now, or should I save it to go with Chris?
Oh yeah, okay. Well, you can hold your number two, and I'll do my number two, which pairs neatly with Master and Commander. It's Mutiny on the Bounty.
I'll live to see you, all of you, hanging from the highest yardarm in the British fleet.
Which I think one of us made reference to, Chris, on the Crimson Tide Rewatchables.
Yeah, you were talking about it, yeah.
I had just recently revisited it, even before I knew I was going to do this. And I'm referring to the 1935 version of this movie, starring Clark Gable and Peter Lawton. We talked about Peter Lawton on the Witness for the Prosecution courtroom dramas episode. And he gives an insane, incredible performance as Captain Bly in this movie. It's a very old movie, but it is as riveting to me today as it was probably when it was first made. It's the story of a mutiny, of an evil captain who essentially punishes his crew as they sail the world to Tahiti. And it features some of the great showdowns between two generations of actors. And the reason I was making the comparison was we were talking about Hackman and Denzel Washington and sort of Clark Gable as the young on the come up star and Charles Laughton as one of the most celebrated actors of his time. And it's got incredible speech findings based on a true story. The film does fudge a bit with the facts of the mutiny and the subsequent expulsion of Captain Bly, but it is an amazing showcase and also just an amazing production given the time. The movie was made 85 years ago, and it's still pretty credible as a seafaring adventure movie, and probably would pair neatly with Master and Commander since it's set in sort of a similar time frame. So if you are looking for one of the great showcase acting movies of all time, Mutiny on the Bounty is for you. Amanda and Chris, why don't you guys team up on your number one? Who should announce it?
Ramius might be trying to defect.
Do you mean to suggest that this man has
proceed,
come...
Mr. Ryan?
Amanda, you say it.
Well, no, it's your number one, and it's my number two, though. I woke up this morning, and I was like, I should have put this at number one. I'm weak, and this is one of the great films. So, Chris, why don't you introduce it?
It's One Ping Only. It's Hunt for October.
One Ping Only.
Give me a ping, Vasily.
That was good, Amanda.
Yeah.
Thank you. It's literally the only voice work that I can do. And so I just said it about 45 times last night after watching it.
When Columbus arrived at the New World, he burned his ships.
Why is The Hunt for Red October so good, guys?
I will tell you. First of all, two absolutely fucking phenomenal lead performances from Sean Connery, which this is his actual great victory lap performance, not The Untouchables. I mean, The Untouchables is really good, but this is, once you get past the he is a Scottish man pretending to be Lithuanian, you know, he is unbelievable in this movie. He's so good. And this is Baldwin right before he threw it away. It's Baldwin when you're like, oh, that's Harrison Ford. He's going to be the biggest male movie star of my lifetime, probably. And then he kind of goes off the rails for a while there. And tellingly, Harrison Ford took over the role of Jack Ryan after Alec Baldwin. So obviously he was onto something. No movie has ever actually, one of the hardest things to do when you're doing a submarine movie is to make underwater make any sense, because there's no actual landmarks. There's no, the idea of a sense of space, really all you're limited to is the walls of inside of these submarines. And for anybody who doesn't know, The Hunt for October is about a Russian nuclear sub that sets sail in a training exercise. It's the newest worst version of a submarine, because it is basically a nuclear killing machine that leaves port. And quickly, once it leaves port, it becomes obvious that he is this the ship commander played by Sean Connery, Ramius, has either gone mad or is going to defect. And it's essentially a chase to find out which one he has chosen. And once you find that out, it's a chase to find out whether or not he can get away with it. And Alec Baldwin plays Jack Ryan, who is a CIA analyst who's basically just like a nerd who winds up getting thrown into this incredibly action-packed scenario. And one of the things that's so cool about it is all of the action, you're like with Jack Ryan step by step, and he's like, I can't do this. Like, I don't know how to jump out of a helicopter onto a submarine. This seems crazy, but he knows he has to do it for the sake of basically humanity. And this movie, actually, when you're watching it, John McTiernan, who directed it, you feel like when you're watching submarines underwater, you're watching a car chase. You're like, oh, that's the Laurentian abyss, and that's Thor's turn, and they've got to get under this, and they have to get to the torpedoes before the torpedoes arm themselves. It's like, it might as well be like an incredible car chase movie, but it's happening underwater with these giant, giant submarines. What am I missing, Amanda?
Well, I think that there is also a human element to it, in addition to just like the preposterous technical lingo. And they spend just a lot of time saying all sorts of like sonar stuff. But there is always, because the submarine is new and because Jack Ryan is explaining things to everybody else, they do a great job of translating it into like completely unusable, but in real life, but followable technology. And then I'm always struck by the Sam Neill performance, which is just really, he gets one great speech about what he wants to do when he gets to America. And then, you know, spoiler alert, I wanted to see Montana, but every single time it gets me. And it has that real like 80s, 90s studio, we need to give you like one saccharine sentimental plot line to follow. I guess I have a couple because you have Sean Connery's backstory of his wife. But you know, as we learned on the Courtroom Dramas podcast, I am just a real mark for a movie about movie stars in uniforms who discover like higher principles that also somehow align with like centrist right policies of the late 80s and early 90s. But that's okay. that's okay. It's a movie. It's not real life. It's not politics. And Sean Connery is just such a lord in this. Like, instantly he walks on the boat. Once more, we play our dangerous game. I'm like, sure, whatever you want to do. You want to just yell about
it.
And then I have to be honest, I find that last sequence like borderline unfollowable. I don't know what they're doing, because they're just, the torpedoes are going eight different ways, and then it's armed and then it's not armed, and then you're turning around a cliff, and then they're just like yelling about different sonar technologies. But no, that's a seismic recording. I don't really know, but I don't care, because it's so cool. And that's the other thing, is that submarines are terrifying to me. I never want to be on a submarine. It's really, really, it just seems very claustrophobic, even though I'm not a hugely claustrophobic person. But there is an element to this movie and to submarines in general where it's just like, we didn't have to invent all of this. Mm-hmm. And there's like an entire world down there and an entire system of submarines and people fighting each other under the water for really no other reason than like one person decided to do it. And then we all had to do it.
Yeah.
And it is like, it's like going to a different world while still also, while knowing that it does actually exist. And I find that fascinating.
Great, great representation of the seas and the oceans as a, like as geopolitical terrain. Like, there's all mm-hmm. this stuff in the North Atlantic of like, you know, Fred Dalton Thompson is on a boat, and he's just like, this thing will get out of hand and people will die. You know, like, they have like all these great character actors like James Earl Jones, Scott Glenn, Courtney B. Vance are in it. But what it shows is like just how tenuous the sort of the way we've divided up the world is, because you can have something like this that kind of throws that all off.
Let me ask you guys a question. Is Sean Connery the villain of this movie?
No, I think Stellan Skarsgård is. You arrogant ass! You've killed us!
Because I was trying to think about, there was this moment in the early 90s, and I thought of this because Sean Connery appears on the poster of this movie and Alec Baldwin does not, despite the fact that Jack Ryan is the ostensible hero of the movie. And there was this moment in the early 90s where big time movie stars, leading men, took on roles as kind of villains in movies. So you've got, you know, Al Pacino and Dick Tracy, and you've got Robert De Niro in a couple of different movies, actually. You've got him in This Boy's Life, and you've got him in The Fan. And there was this strange trend where they, like, the beat playing the heavy was like the best paycheck you could get if you were a 70s movie star. And but like the movie, just despite the fact that Sean Connery is not Russian, the movie, I don't think this movie works like without him at all. I think if you don't have those like line readings, I think it's a perfectly serviceable action movie, but he just brings a gravitas to it that is indefinable.
I'll be honest, I've seen this movie at least 30 times, and every single time I start it, I'm like, oh yeah, Alec Baldwin's in this movie, because it's just the Sean Connery show. And the way he can just sit in the middle of the deck or whatever it's called, and just kind of spread his arms and look very like satisfied as he's just being like, now, you know, 3 meters behind or whatever he says. I don't know. That's the other thing. He's really playing loose with a strategy that relies a lot on timing. You know about this? Like, they're counting down the seconds to the torpedo and how close it is. And he's sitting there like waiting really intently. But when he gives the command, the guy still has to go from his little post and like run over physically to press the button and do the other things. I don't know whether this timing is replicable in real life.
Although I do think Scott Glenn has the sub move of the movie where he's just like, the problem with playing chicken is knowing when to blink. And it's with fucking submarines. Like, it is crazy how good that is. But yeah, like all this stuff with like the Russian navigator who's like, give me a stopwatch and a map and I can fly a plane through the Alps with no windows. Like, it's just, where do they come up with this shit?
Chris, where does Hunt for Red October sit in the John McTiernan power rankings?
I think it's second behind Die Hard, but ahead of Predator.
Wow. That's bold. Where do you guys stand?
Those are three of my favorite action movies. So,
where do you guys stand on Sean Connery and John McTiernan's follow-up to The Hunt for Red October, Medicine Man? Were you guys in on that?
That's my favorite movie about medicine.
Coming soon. Top
Lorenzo's
10 medicine
oil,
movies.
Number one.
Yeah. Okay. Should we go to my number one?
Yeah, man.
Why didn't you do my number one? That was my number two. Even though
right,
I know I give such a spirited defense of it. And like, honestly, it should be number one. But you know what's number one? It's a little film called Titanic. Maybe you've heard of it.
I figure life's a gift and I don't intend on wasting it. You never know what hand you're going to get dealt next. You learn to take life as it comes at you. Oh, here you go, Cal.
Listen, there is no movie that is number one showing all the possibilities that can happen on the ocean, because you have romance, you have adventure, you have class warfare, you have some like really weak sauce science that becomes to be part of the problem. You have death, spoiler, sorry, if you haven't caught those memes for the past 20 years about how there was room for Leo on the wood. And then you also have James Cameron's like weird submarines or whatever he puts Bill Paxton in throughout the movie so that we can go find the heart of the ocean. It's got it all. It teaches you to respect the ocean, which is kind of one of my primary concerns as discussed on this podcast. And is it possibly the most seen movie about the ocean ever?
Definitely.
Has to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. There we go. And we learned lessons from it, and we've applied them for the most part. So that's useful.
What lessons did we learn?
Well,
always
we
pay
learned
for first class seats.
That's true. And maybe have two people on the observation deck, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like one of the key lessons is don't fall in love with the riffraff, you know? Okay. Wow. Marry up. Always marry up.
Okay.
Jeez. Okay.
I have not seen Titanic since Titanic came out. Now, when it came out,
no way, really?
That's crazy. What are you doing?
I think I saw it 3 times in theaters. Yeah. Once for the first time. The second time, I think I was dragged to it, and the third time because I liked it. Maybe I should revisit Titanic.
Mm-hmm. Titanic. When I was living in Ireland, it played at the movie theater in Cork for like, I think the entire time I was there. So I think I saw it like 8 times in the theater. Because it was literally like that or whatever they turned over at the art house movie theater. And we went to the movies a lot because it was constantly raining in Ireland. So like I just saw Titanic so many times in the theaters.
It's pretty hard to overstate the phenomenon that was Titanic and how you know, how sort of denigrated the movie had become before it came out. It was mm-hmm. it was chronicled as this huge disaster from James Cameron for months and months in Premier Magazine and in Entertainment Weekly and in all the trades. It was thought to be this, you know, huge boondoggle, and Cameron, who is obsessed with the sea and had previously made The Abyss, which didn't make any of our lists, unfortunately, but is a pretty cool movie. And it turned out to just be the exact opposite. And it's part of the reason why, even if we make jokes about Avatar 2 from time to time on this podcast, I'm just not underestimating Avatar 2. Pretty much every single time James Cameron decides he wants every single person in the world to see one of his movies, he gets what he wants. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens if that. I mean, I don't even know how Avatar 2 gets made at this point, but Terminator, Aliens, Terminator 2, Titanic, Avatar, over and over again, he manages to capture the world's imagination. Maybe a Titanic rewatch is in the offing for me soon. My number one is Jaws.
Some moray eel fit right through my wetsuit. Well, nope, no, listen, I don't know about that, but I entered an arm wrestling contest in an Oki bar in San Francisco. You see this? Now I can't extend that. Do you know why? Got to the semifinal, celebrating my third wife's demise. Big Chinese fella, pull me right off.
Amanda, I don't think that we've ever talked about Jaws on this podcast. Chris and I certainly have in one of the most spirited rewatchables episodes we've ever done.
Yes, that's true.
Amanda goes Jaws. In the water.
Jaws is in a classic. The water. Also, again, Jaws accurately reflects many of my fears, both in terms of the ocean and also, you know, bureaucracy of a small town community. So it's got it all for me.
Amanda, can I ask you a quick cue?
Yeah.
Where are you at on Roy Scheider in Jaws?
You mean in terms of attractiveness?
Yeah, I'm curious whether or not, like, because, like, I personally think that, like, Roy Scheider jeans and cut-off sweatshirt is, like, about as ideal of a man as you can be. But
do you want to fuck Roy Scheider, Chris?
If I was, like, stuck on a boat forever, I mean, like...
Are you asking about the fashion here? Are you trying to get permission to wear jean shorts?
I'm just asking how you feel about it. Yeah, I mean, like, I'll take the information and run with it wherever I need to go, but I'm curious.
Yeah, I love, like, a beach casual, but more of a locals vibe than the guy who comes into town with his, you know, Nantucket Reds or Martha's right. Vineyard Reds, as the right. case may be. So I'm pro, and I think if you want to take up life in a small beach town community and wear jean shorts, I support you. I'll come visit as long as, you know, we have, you know, surveyed the seas appropriately ahead of time.
I think I missed my window for that. I think that would be pretty weird now. If I just showed up in like a Cape Cod community wearing jean shorts, I think people would be like...
I mean, Chief Brody he's a retired police officer. I think he's a New York City police officer, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And he moves to this beach community. He moves to Amity. And he starts a new life for himself, and he redefines his persona, and everybody out in the beach community knows he's the city slicker and that he's kind of afraid of the ocean, and yet he takes this gig. Would it be so different for a celebrity blogger and podcaster extraordinaire like yourself, Chris, to just change your tact on life?
Would I become a cop yourself? Or would I be like the DJ at the local radio station in Amity? Maybe that could be my gig.
That sounds like what you want to do. Is that what you want to do? You want to be the local DJ?
The lines are open. Talk Amity. Call me up. Let me know what's going on.
I don't know what else we need to say about Jaws in particular. Is it the most fun movie ever made? Is it the most rewatchable movie ever made?
I'm gonna pencil screw you a little bit here.
Okay.
Does too much of Jaws happen on land for this to be a sea movie?
No, the whole entire third act takes place at sea, and it is in fact the archetypal film at sea. You've got these mangy dogs telling stories below deck. You've got an incredibly thrilling showdown with a sea creature. You've got a ship breaking down and the peril and existential dread that comes with it. It's perfect at sea movie. It's got all the things you need.
John, I'm just asking the questions, man. I mean, like, you know,
I'm defending vigorously.
Yeah. Well, sure.
I think it's also, the thing is that while obviously Jaws is the monster of the movie, the unknowability that you guys were talking about at the beginning of this conversation, I think is such a key part of the dread that builds and builds and builds over the story and what's out at sea and what Quint is kind of is aiming at and what Dreyfus's character is saying is so powerful and overwhelming. There is this sort of slow build to the ambient dread that comes with this experience. And then once we actually get out on the sea, it's thrilling and exciting and funny and strange. And it's a story about friendship. It's a story about being eaten alive by a giant shark. It's got it all. Jaws is one of the greats.
I mean, Jaws is one of my favorite movies ever made. I you know, you're never going to hear me argue about that.
Would you like me to move Finding Nemo up to number one, Chris? Amanda, what do you think? Am I pushing the limits of what this should be?
I mean, in terms of if you can see the coast, you know, if you can see land, it doesn't count, which is what Captain Chris stated is the rubric for this. I did have some questions, but you make a decent point. I wanted to ask you, in terms of things that scare you about the sea, not to just bring this back to my fears at all the times, but is it more about the creatures, like say in Jaws, or is it about like a tidal wave? Is it about being lost? Like, where would you locate your sea fears?
I think a lot of my fears are much more modest than that. I have these sense memories of getting caught in the riptide as a kid and mm-hmm. being stuck underwater for that extra 12 or 14 seconds and feeling like I'll never be able to come back to my feet. I'll never be able to get back to land. And that's really terrifying. Very quick story. I used to go to the Outer Banks as a kid with my family on summer vacation. And one summer, we were swimming out in the ocean, and I like to swim very far out in the ocean. And I was very far out, and I'll never forget, in the far distance, I could hear the voice of my grandmother screaming at me in the ocean. And she was screaming loudly on a crowded beach, "Shark. There is a shark." Hundreds of people came in from the ocean as she was screaming shark, and then more people started screaming shark. And in fact, it was not a shark, it was dolphins. There were dolphins swimming behind us, and it looked like a shark. No. But that very small moment is really the only time I've ever been afraid of what could be out in the sea. And it was proven to just be an immensely friendly mammal. Not a shark.
It could have been like a great Instagram photo for you, and your grandmother ruined it.
Well, I was basically crying in the ocean, so I'm glad that was not captured. What about you guys? What actually are you afraid of?
I'll tell you right now, top three things I'm scared of all happen in the ocean if things go wrong. A, getting eaten. Don't want that to happen at all. B, drowning. That just, because like you're just completely like, I'm drowning. And three,
you're just completely like, I'm drowning?
Yeah, because like the whole thing with drowning is like you're aware that it's going to happen and that it's happening.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And number three is being stranded somewhere and being forced to drink my own pee.
Is that the number one thing you're afraid of?
No, it's number three. Number one is being eaten. Number two is drowning. Oh, okay. And number three is being so dehydrated, I have to drink my own pee.
So that episode of Better Call Saul must have been haunting for you.
Yes, it totally is. But I don't even know if it works. That's the problem. I don't even have that information so that if I get stranded out there, like, and I'm castaway, like, I don't even know. Like,
let's find out right now, Chris. Why don't you drink your own urine live on this show? We'll find out,
dude,
whether this works.
The numbers that this would do, you'd fucking owe me for that, man. Really. when you put up Rogan numbers because CR drank his own number one. Don't ever fucking say I don't do things for you.
I've never said that. You really are the Quint of this podcast. Amanda, what are you most afraid of?
Well, now I'm afraid of that. And now I'm afraid of having to watch Chris drink his own pee.
That's what you're afraid of?
No. I'm afraid of a tidal wave. I'm afraid of the power of the ocean. At the creature, they're going to get me or they're not going to get me. I don't know. I, like you guys heard, I've been warring with a lot of creatures in nature recently, and I kind of see them more as equal adversaries. So it's just like, I'll do the best that I can do, and the shark will do the best that it can do. And like, you know, two men enter, one man leaves. But there's something about the power Like the riptides, Sean, as you said. Like, and anytime you guys said tidal wave on this podcast, I just got very stressed out. You know, when you're near the ocean and then you're driving away and you see the sign that says like you are leaving the tsunami zone. I mean, have you guys ever noticed that? That there are like signs on the side of the road if you make it to a certain elevation that you're
no longer in
like a... Wow. Okay. Well, I'm like basically looking out for them at all times. So I'll let you know when we leave the tsunami zone because I just feel like such a relief because I think tsunami, especially, you know, tidal wave, anything really big, like, you know, it's coming and there's nothing you can do. It is a little bit like being stuck in the ocean and this giant thing that is way more powerful than you is coming and you're stuck. And that anticipation is just is absolutely it's terrifying to me.
That's resonant. In the Poseidon Adventure, the movie essentially opens with Leslie Nielsen looking at a sonar and realizing, you know, 20, 30 minutes before the tidal wave actually hits that this whole ship is fucked and that there is like something so terrifying about that. And then the movie goes into this really elegant explanation of why, like showing you who the characters are going to be, who are going to survive the capsizing, you know, and it shows their character arcs very cleverly. A friend of mine who is a screenwriter was telling me about why it's one of the most teachable movies ever made because it shows you the arc of each character in the first 20 minutes of the movie. But the biggest character in the movie, as in so many of these movies, is that tidal wave and the sea.
Nature, yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. So, guys, one last question for you before we wrap this up. If you had to be eaten by a sea creature, which sea creature would you like to be eaten by? Amanda, why don't you start first?
Oh, wow. I guess I'm looking for something that can, you know, go in one bite. I don't want to prolong it. I understood what Chris was saying where he's just like, oh, no, I'm drowning, because you don't want to be aware of it. I think it's called a jaguar shark in the Life Aquatic. It's obviously a made up white whale who is a shark and who is ultimately very beautiful. But he looked quite powerful and also like he could get the job done efficiently. That's what I'm looking for.
Chris, what about you?
You know, I would love to go out with some notoriety and get taken out by like a truly fantastical, like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea type like super octopus or whatever, like tear me apart, you know, but like, that would still be kind of cool, you know, because I would always need to be cited. Like, oh, remember when how did Chris die? Oh, I got torn apart by like a mythical beast, you know, like I think that would be, and when you guys talked about me, it would be like, God damn, like, and that was pretty cool. You know what I mean? Like, it wouldn't be as sad. You know what I mean? Like that.
And he tried to drink his own urine halfway through to save the day, but it didn't work.
Yeah, he had plenty of water, but like he just wanted the experience. What about you, Sean?
You know, I was gonna say a 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea giant squid, but maybe a better answer is like what would seem like a friendly creature. You know, like maybe I made friends with a turtle.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And then the turtle takes me to its family of turtles, and then I'm attacked by the turtle family. You know,
yeah,
like nature really turns on me.
Turtles. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think? Is that good?
That's awesome. I like the idea of like the like friendly parts of the sea turning Breaking Bad on you.
That's exactly
what
I was
imagining.
The one
thing I won't be doing, and I'll tell you this, and I'll tell all the listeners this, and you can hold me to it, is if I ever get attacked by a great white or any kind of shark, and I have like massive tissue loss, I'm not going to be one of those inspiring people who get back in the ocean. You ever hear about them? Like where it's like this surfer lost half his thigh, but look at him. He's out there at Point Dana just getting after it with his prosthetic leg. And I'm like, no, I will be living in Iowa. You will not see me near a coast ever again if I get massive tissue damage.
So you're not the Bethany Hamilton of this podcast, the soul surfer.
Sorry. No.
Amanda, what about you? If you lose a limb to the sea, will you return to the sea?
I will, probably, just because I really like it. But number one, probably more in like a rehab capacity. And again, it's going to be a fluke. I'm a pretty cautious swimmer, as Chris definitely knows. I'm monitoring the situation, and I'm not going to get in if it looks like any danger is going to come my way. I'm really trying to stick close to shore. So, you know, you can't take that love away from me. No great white can take the love of the sea, even if they take
the great
one of my
whites
arms.
Of the world are like challenge accepted.
Hopefully they're not listening to this podcast. Chris and Amanda, I appreciate you guys opening your souls really here and talking about what you fear most. and also maybe like slightly what titillates you sexually when you think about the sea. This has been a very useful podcast, I would say. One of the most important pods we've ever done.
To whom?
Well, I feel like if anybody wants to psychoanalyze us, you can get a little bit more clarity.
That's what's great about sea movies.
Please stay tuned to The Big Picture. This trio will be returning later this week to talk about a different kind of terror. I'm talking, of course, about the new film Capone, directed by the iconic Josh Trank. And we're also going to be focusing on the films of Tom Hardy, the star of Capone. We'll see you then.
Hell yes.